journalism is to question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
Just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free of all minds. These are weapons of mass
These
dissent.
These are weapons of mass dissent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Wednesday, March 28th, 2012, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar.
It just makes me stop and think. Silence is not an option.
A new study on the dangers of chemical exposure, how conservation groups have taken greenwashing to a new level, and Val Kilmer on his one-man show Citizen Twain, plus this week's activist beat. But I can't help myself, why should I? This is Uprising. Good morning and welcome to Uprising. The Food and Drug Administration is under a deadline to decide whether or not to ban the synthetic estrogen and additive to plastic, bisphenol A, better known as BPA, from all food containers. 4 years ago, the Natural Resources Defense Council petitioned the FDA to ban the chemical from food containers. But instead of responding within 180 days with a decision as required, the FDA did nothing. The NRDC sued the FDA, and a court has now ordered the federal administration to issue a yes or no decision by this Saturday, March 31st. BPA is an industrial chemical found in plastics, used in everything from children's sippy cups to trash bags to the lining of aluminium cans. Studies have shown that the chemical may be linked to many diseases and disorders, including the onset of early puberty, as well as infertility. But there is no smoking gun study showing a direct cause and effect link between low-dose chemical exposure and health disorders. Industry groups representing the myriad manufacturers that use BPA have lobbied the FDA against stronger regulation, citing a lack of evidence proving harm. In fact, many chemicals that are shown to be dangerous to humans at high-dose levels are cleared for consumption in low doses because immediate deleterious effects are hard to prove. To fill this information gap, a group of scientists has just reviewed 800 scientific studies on hormone-disrupting chemicals and found that the body of research actually shows a strong link between exposure to low doses of hormone disruptors and health problems in humans. Joining me on the phone is Elizabeth Grossman. She is the author of Chasing Molecules, Poisonous Products, Human Health, and other books. Her work has appeared in Scientific American, Salon, The Washington Post, The Nation, Mother Jones, Grist, and more. Welcome to Uprising, Elizabeth.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So I understand the justification, as I mentioned, that is often given for the presence of these sorts of chemicals is that we're supposed to believe that in very low doses, they don't harm humans, that if these chemicals fly under the radar, if you will, of our immune systems, that we wouldn't be harmed by them. Is that accurate?
Well, it turns out that that's not always true. What scientists have discovered over the past, 10 to 15, almost 20 years now, is that there are a great number of synthetic chemicals that actually behave very much in the way that human hormones do, and that these chemicals can have very significant health effects at very low levels of exposure.
And hormones determine a very, very large number of our body's functions, right?
Yes, they're responsible for regulating a great number of the body's most vital functions, metabolism, reproductive health, developmental health. They're even involved in immune system, cardiovascular health, neurological health. So they're incredibly important, it turns out, at every stage of a person's life.
So a chemical like bisphenol A or BPA, if one eats a can of soup, which is lined with BPA, and that chemical gets into one's body, it does mimic estrogen and could disrupt the way in which estrogen works in our bodies. Is that a way to look at it?
Yes.
And so what exactly did this survey find? Because it has been quite convenient for manufacturers and the FDA to say that there's no study or more information is needed, more studies are needed. Do we now have that study?
Well, that's what the authors of this review paper say. And there are 12 authors on the study, and they looked at more than 800 scientific studies and came to the conclusion that this kind of behavior on the part of chemicals that can act like hormones, the fact that they can be biologically active at very low levels of exposure, the conclusion of this paper was that that behavior is remarkably common. In fact, what they said was that it was remarkably common for low levels of these kind of chemicals to have profound adverse effects on human health.
So essentially, this is a survey, a large-scale survey of existing studies that brings together a bunch of collective data.
Exactly.
I want to quote from the study where the paper's authors write, and you write this in your article about it. They say, whether low doses of endocrine-disrupting compounds influence human disorders is no longer conjecture, as epidemiological studies show that environmental exposures are associated with human diseases and disabilities. And for scientists to make a strong claim like that is pretty significant.
It is. And it's, I mean, this is an area of research that has been These studies have just been piling up just with great frequency over the past 10 years or so, and a growing number of scientists, in addition to the authors of all the studies collected here and the people who put this paper together, have been expressing concern about the effects of this kind of chemical exposure on human health, particularly the effects on infants and children, and even the effects of exposure to infants before they're born, while they're still in utero.
So bisphenol A is just one of many chemicals. Can you give our listeners an example, if they're not aware of what we mean when we say hormone-disrupting chemicals, where one could have this kind of exposure?
Well, as you mentioned, bisphenol A, other chemicals which can behave like this are chemicals that have been used as flame retardants, also in
children's pajamas.
Some of them have been in children's pajamas. Another place that they've been used with great in great quantity has been in upholstery foams, sort of things that go into couch cushions and seat cushions and carpet backing, and also into plastics of appliances. There are other compounds that have been used to make fabrics and even papers grease-resistant and stain-resistant, and little bits of these kind of chemicals can rub off. You can sort of accidentally sort of inhale them or ingest them with household dust, and there have been lots of studies that have found numerous chemicals that behave this way in household dust, which means they're in indoor air and creates a lot of exposure potential.
Also, I understand chemicals called parabens, which are present in cosmetics and other personal care products. I mean, these chemicals are everywhere.
Yeah, I mean, it turns out that there are hundreds of chemicals that can behave like this. And one of the things that makes it a very tricky area of study, as I think was sort of mentioned in the introduction to our speaking, is that while you can see these effects will not always affect everybody equally, it takes a long time for the impacts to show up. And it is difficult just because of the nature of this kind of hormonal system it's not like being burned by an acid or inhaling something that makes you immediately sick. It takes a long time for these effects to show up.
And different people's bodies respond differently, right? I mean, it's not that they affect people uniformly?
Exactly.
And so has that been a challenge in establishing the cause and effect?
It has, it will remain that way because there are multiple factors. If there is a chemical which is true of a number of endocrine and other hormone-disrupting chemicals that can affect fertility in different ways or reproductive development. There are a number of different things that could also have those effects, so pinpointing them makes it very difficult in a precise human health study. But at this point, there is an enormous amount of data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention that has been monitoring the presence of these chemicals in human blood and tissue and urine samples, so that we now know that the majority of Americans are exposed to multiple chemicals that behave like this.
And how much of our exposure has to simply do with lax regulation here in the United States? Because chemicals like BPA are banned in other countries, and it seems as though our policy for what is acceptable whenever a new chemical is synthesized in the laboratory and unleashed upon the public is simply wait until somebody dies of it or there's enough public uproar before we pull it off the shelves.
Well, the system that we have that regulates chemicals that go into commercial products, there's one major law that does this. It's the Toxic Substance Control Act, and it sets a very, very high bar for determining what is an unsafe chemical, and that makes it extremely difficult to get a chemical completely taken off the market. And it does make it difficult to completely ban chemicals under that system.
And so what effect do you think the results of this paper that we're discussing may have on policy and on government agencies that are supposed to regulate these chemicals, like the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration?
Well, the EPA has certainly been taking this science into account, and it has been working pretty hard within the limitations that it has under the Toxic Substance Control Act to get this new science into its chemical regulation. And from a public health perspective, one would hope that the science is also being taken into account by the FDA, which regulates chemicals that go into products that come in contact with food and also in cosmetics.
I'm speaking with Elizabeth Grossman, author of Chasing Molecules, Poisonous Products, Human Health, and other books. She has written in such publications as Scientific American, Salon, The Washington Post, The Nation, and more. And we're talking about a new survey of studies, scientific studies, on the effects of hormone-disrupting chemicals such as bisphenol A. Well, so at this point, what can the public do about these sorts of issues given a study like this?
Well, I mean, it's pretty tricky. One thing you can do is, if you are concerned about these health effects, try and avoid products that have them in them. It is a little tricky. Some of these things will not turn up on labels. You will not see a lot of ingredients like flame retardants listed on products. There's no requirement to list those. But if you're concerned about some of the preservatives or antibacterials, one of the substances that was included in the study in this review paper was an antibacterial called triclosan or triclosan, however you want to pronounce it, that turns up in a lot of soaps and even in toothpaste. You could look at an ingredient label and decide that you don't actually want to use that. If people are really concerned about some products that contain certain flame retardants or bisphenol A, and they would like their legislators to do something about it, they can talk to them about it. I typically don't necessarily advocate for particular legislators.
Sure. Right. And I mean, the issue.
Those are things that people can do.
The issue that you brought up about personal action is certainly valid, and a lot of people can do that, but it also becomes a class issue when we think
Absolutely.
About those who can afford to shop for safer products at health food outlets like Whole Foods, where you can buy a BPA-free bottle for your infant to drink milk out of, whereas people who have worse incomes, much lower incomes, wouldn't have that luxury. And so, you know, it certainly seems as though relying on the government to regulate these chemicals is something that that does need much more work on.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. And one of the interesting things is that based on public concern for BPA, particularly in baby bottles and infant sippy cups, well ahead of any regulation, most of the major manufacturers, or virtually all of the major manufacturers of these products, have shifted to other materials, and they're now available in virtually every retailer that carries these products. Obviously, one of the issues that we have under our current system is knowing if the new products on the shelf are also safe.
Right.
And that's kind of a whole other discussion. And one of the things that I'm personally concerned with is, as you mentioned, asking consumers to rely on reading very complex chemical names on labels, something that an awful lot of people don't have the time to do. And even when I read some of these labels, I don't know what all of these things are and how anybody could expect a parent in a rush to be able to read this fine print and decide whether they're going to buy a tube of toothpaste or not is, I don't think that's a really good way to plan to do this.
Well, Elizabeth, where can listeners find out more about your work? And we'll certainly do a follow-up on the sorts of legislation that there is out there, even at the state level, in states like California, where these issues are pursued pretty aggressively. Where can listeners read your article about this new study?
The article that I wrote about this study is at Yale Environment 360 online, and it has links to the study itself, which is easy to find, and there are links to a whole lot of other sources of information in that article.
We'll find that and post it on uprisingradio.org later today. Elizabeth Grossman, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Elizabeth Grossman is the author of Chasing Molecules, Poisonous Products, Human Health, and her work has appeared in Scientific American, Salon, The Washington Post, The Nation, Mother Jones, Grist, and other publications. We've been talking about the link between low doses of chemicals like bisphenol A and human health. This is Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. Later in the hour, we'll speak with Val Kilmer, who is performing a one-man play about Mark Twain at the Hollywood Forever Cemetery. We'll also hear this week's activist beat with Rose Aguilar. And after this short break, greenwashing taken to a whole new level. Stay tuned.
KPFK.
Powered by the people.
Educating the people on the illnesses in society.
I'm Andrew Tonkovich, host of Bibliocracy on Wednesday nights at 8. Tune in for a special performance edition of the program when short story alchemist Dwight Yates reads a complete standalone short story. Yates is the author of two prize-winning collections, Haywire Hearts and Slide Trombones and Bring Everybody. His stories are intimate, generous, sly considerations of family and relationships, of characters made strong in their weakness or foolish and vulnerable. Gentle and yet precise, Dwight Yates' elegant and beautiful prose offers empathetic and wise portrayals which reinvigorate the artfulness of fiction. Listen to a complete short story read on the radio by one of our most esteemed writers, Dwight Yates, Wednesday night at 8 on Bibliocracy.
Thank you.
Revolution by Stonefeather, based here in Los Angeles. More online at facebook.com/stonefeathermusic or check the featured music section of uprisingradio.org later today. This is Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. Wikipedia defines greenwashing as, quote, a form of spin in which green PR or green marketing is deceptively used to promote the perception that a company's policies or products are environmentally friendly. Bioscientist Jonathan Latham delves deeper into the issue of greenwashing in an article in this month's Dollars and Cents magazine, and he uncovers that some of the biggest conservation nonprofits are shockingly headed by CEOs of major corporations like Coca-Cola and Bank of America. The current leader in the greenwashing industrial commodity agriculture is the World Wide Fund for Nature, better known as the World Wildlife Fund. Latham found that the World Wildlife Fund's stated role is to, quote, negotiate standards, provide credibility, and lubricate the entry of certified products into international markets. However, as of 2012, major corporations sit on WWF boards. Members of the Roundtable on Responsible Soy include Monsanto, Cargill, Nestle, and BP, companies known to be against environmental regulation and known to be harming the environment through their practices. Identifying the hypocrisy in this scheme, Latham wonders, quote, how many members of the Nature Conservancy will be pleased to find that their organization has been working with Monsanto to promote genetically modified crops as responsible? Jonathan Latham is the executive director of the Bioscience Resource Project based in Ithaca, New York. He now joins me on the phone. Welcome to Uprising, Jonathan.
Good morning.
Good morning, and thanks so much for joining us. Well, first, when we think about some of these conservation groups as the World Wildlife Fund, the Nature Conservancy, these are certainly nonprofit organizations that are meant to be promoting the planetary good. But how is it that their boards have come to be occupied by CEOs of major corporations? Did it start out that way?
In some cases, it did. The World Wildlife Fund was founded by Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands. And so, you know, these organizations have their origins in elite people, if you like, who are friendly with corporations by virtue of what they do and who they are, basically.
And so what exactly are we looking at here in terms of the effects on the planet? Because now more and more people are concerned about climate change, about the environment. It's becoming mainstream. And when we, you know, go to major department stores or retail outlets and we see a stamp on a product that says that it is environmentally friendly, how seriously can we take that?
Well, I think, firstly, it's an extremely important issue. It's hard to overestimate the importance of the sustainability of our food supply. So if you think about the issues that people care about these days, things like coral reefs, things like climate change, things like rainforests, things like habitat protection, all these issues, if you look at them closely enough, you'll see that the food system is the number one problem that these issues face. So the rainforests are being cut down for palm oil plantations, for example. Coral reefs are being threatened by runoff from agricultural fields. So the issue is incredibly important. And basically the food supply is steadily becoming greenwashed. So you know, if you go to the supermarket, you'll find that there are green labels on all sorts of different things that you can buy. And the food system is basically responding to consumer concerns to develop systems to offer more of those kinds of packaging and greenwashing possibilities.
So what you're saying is that the efforts are being put into labeling products as, say, organic or environmentally sustainable, but not actually practicing them.
Well, in some cases, I mean, I would make a distinction between, you know, there are some things like fair trade and organic that have transparent standards that are upheld by the people who sell the product.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's another category of labels where, like the sustainable soybeans and the responsible palm oil that I looked into, where the standards appear to have no reasonable basis at all. You basically are not buying anything when you buy these.
So when they use these terms that don't necessarily have a formal certification attached to them, words like responsible and sustainable. Let's talk about the World Wildlife Fund in particular. What do members of the World Wildlife Fund have to be concerned about with this organization?
Well, I think, you know, there are good things that the World Wildlife Fund does. You know, they do research on habitats, and sometimes they stand up for the right things. But, you know, increasingly they're becoming interested in these sustainability schemes and partnerships with companies. And they are basically the importance of the issues that these sustainability partnerships address outweigh the importance of the research that they do. So, you know, for instance, the World Wildlife Fund could educate its members about the fundamental importance of sustainability in the food supply. But if you read these organizations' magazines, in my opinion, they're full of pap.
So they are working with, and the World Wildlife Fund, whose one of its main goals is to stop deforestation. You say in your article about this in Dollars and Cents magazine that the World Wildlife Fund is essentially giving in to major agricultural industrial companies and giving their maybe what stamp of approval in exchange for some kind of future sustainability goal?
Well, they appear to hope that some rainforests will be saved as a consequence of these schemes. But what the World Wildlife Fund is offering sometimes is positive publicity for these companies, for example, on press releases. And at the moment, companies' products are not being produced with the word WWF on them for the most part. But you know, that is something that may happen in the future. But at the moment, the greenwashing that they're getting from these particular schemes, a lot of it is kind of hidden within the system. You know, as marketing managers and PR people within the system are kind of being worked around to the idea that these soybeans and this palm oil is sustainable, so that when they get to gets to the marketing stage, then it will feel like a whole scheme is in place, if you like.
And so what is being sacrificed then? What is the World Wildlife Fund, the Nature Conservancy, Conservation International, these major organizations that you point out in your article, what are the deals that they have come to with some major companies?
Well, the standards, for example, there is sustainable palm oil, there's responsible soybeans, there is one called Bon Sucro, which is a sugar scheme, there is a cotton scheme. But basically, these schemes, what's being sacrificed is, firstly, in countries like the United States, they're undermining genuine standards like organic and fair trade. But in developing countries where the farming is actually being done, where the growing is being done, the mangrove swamps are still being cut down for shrimp farming, and the rainforest is still being cut down for palm oil, for example, and habitats are being destroyed for soybeans. There's no benefit from these schemes.
So what are you saying, that the World Wildlife Fund and Nature Conservancy, et cetera, are agreeing to not activate their members to alert them to some of what these companies are doing, with the promise that these companies will go green in the future?
Well, I don't think there's anything in writing. There's nothing I've seen in writing which they agree to do this. But obviously, they have they have partnerships with these companies, and you know, if you look at the structure of these organizations, it's not only that the board members and the CEO are from big companies, but it's also that a lot of the senior management people are from, you know, their last job was at Goldman Sachs, for example. So you know, these people are not lifelong conservationists in many cases. The senior management are people who've been in the corporate sector the whole time, and so they don't have a campaigning mentality. You know, the opportunity for these schemes to come along is basically originates from the fact that there have been campaigns against palm oil, for example, to boycott palm oil, that have been very effective in making the companies concerned that they may lose their markets. And so basically these are the opportunities that are being lost of information and campaigning for the rainforest in countries like the United States.
And so there's also this revolving door between corporations, the corporate executives, and the boards of these many of these nonprofits. What about soy? Let's talk about soy, because soy is a very important issue and has been brought up certainly in regard to Brazilian rainforests. And soy is used now widely as feed for cattle on an industrial scale. You write about the Roundtable on Responsible Soy in your article in Dollars and Cents magazine. What is this roundtable?
Well, basically, the roundtable was instigated by the WWF, and they wanted to bring together different players from the food supply system. So it has growers in it, so people who actually grow soybeans in Brazil. But then there are also processors, there are packagers, there are supermarkets in the United States and supermarkets in Brazil. So it's the entire food supply that has to be brought on board with a system like this. So they get together and they sort out what they consider to be reasonable standards. But the problem is there's two or three NGOs, and they call it a round table in the sense that everybody has equal input. But unfortunately, there's more than 100 multinational companies on these boards. So, you know, even if the aims of the WWF were straightforward and merely interested in conservation, it would be extremely difficult for them to argue for high standards when you've got 100 other companies arguing against you for basically who wants to do business as usual.
So these companies then in this roundtable on responsible soy will set up certain standards that sound like they might be positive, like, as you quote, pollution is minimized, production waste is managed responsibly, vague terms that are easy to fulfill or maybe easy to fulfill or to be, you know, to be used to justify the term responsible as a label for their products?
Yes. I mean, what does a standard mean if something just has to be minimized? You know, does that mean you just have to be as good as everyone else and not be worse? The standards are very, very vague. They also they're going to be difficult to enforce. There are no penalties, for example, for companies that fail to meet those standards. So they have kind of high-sounding. You know, if you look at the blurb at the top of these standards, you can make kind of imagine that they're quite good, but the more you look into them, the less likely they are to actually be fulfilled.
So at this point now, Jonathan, what does your article point to in terms of action? Are there other smaller environmental organizations that are noticing this? Because I'm sure in the work of doing environmental conservation, some of the more legitimate organizations that are much more grassroots do come in contact with these bigger organizations, and there must be some knowledge of how these bigger organizations are operating. Is there action on the ground? Are there people that are hoping to expose what the World Wildlife Fund is doing?
There are indeed. What we discovered in our research is that there are a whole series of petitions from a lot of these smaller organizations. So I found more than one petition signed by more than 250 organizations against. There's a petition against the soybeans. There's a petition against the palm oil. There's a petition against the shrimp standard that WWF is also involved in. So there are a lot of smaller organizations who are extremely concerned about these developments.
And can you throw out any names or for listeners who might be interested in becoming active in the environmental movement but are wary now of the larger groups?
Well, my advice to somebody who wants to do good is, you know, you should, you know, if you want to spend money, spending money to absolve your conscience is not, you know, it's not an ideal way to go. But if you want to spend money, then spend it on people that you know, and spend it in your local community, for example, or spend it on local food, for example. If you buy local whole foods, first, it won't have that you'll be doing yourself a health benefit. But also you'll be basically avoiding palm oil, soybean oil, etc., all the foods that these companies are relying on. If people stop buying these, you know, Twinkies and junk food type items, then basically the market for these schemes will evaporate.
And do these petitions show, and even the fact that these many of the big agribusiness companies that are trying to, work with the conservation groups to greenwash their products, is that an indication of progress, if you will, that they fear the activism that people are engaged in?
Well, companies, basically what's happening in the food supply is that it's becoming more and more, consumers are becoming more interested in green issues and ethics of, they don't want their foods made by slaves, for example. They're more interested in sustainability. But the direction of the food industry is in many ways the exact opposite. It's becoming more highly concentrated. It's becoming mm-hmm. more highly controlled. It's becoming more, it's becoming more and more difficult for the big players to deal with small producers. They'd much rather buy their products from all one company. So basically, the entire food system is moving away from sustainability, and yet we have a food movement that is becoming, stronger, especially right. in this country. And so basically, the companies fear the food movement, right? And they're, they're on the boards of these companies because they think of the non-profits. Because they see a way of deflecting the food movement right. from its goal.
Well, Jonathan Latham, I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Jonathan Latham is executive director of the Bioscience Resource Project, and his article in Dollars and Cents magazine can be found online at dollarsandcents.org. This is Uprising. After this week's activist beat, Val Kilmer with his one-man play, Citizen Twain.
I'm Rose Aguilar, host of Your Call on KALW in San Francisco with this week's Activist Beat for Uprising. Each week, I'll bring you a weekly roundup of progressive activism that the mainstream media ignores, undercovers, or misrepresents. Back in August 2009, Uprising brought you a special report about Remote Area Medical, or RAM. It's a traveling health clinic that offers free medical, dental, and vision care. When Stan Brock started RAM in 1985, he never thought his services would be needed in the United States. RAM began as an all-volunteer mobile medical clinic that provided free health care to people living in the remote areas of the Amazon rainforest. In 1992, Stan Brock was asked to bring the clinic to Knoxville, Tennessee. He was shocked by what he saw. People were in need of the most basic care. RAM has been traveling the country ever since. They just finished a 4-day clinic at the Oakland Coliseum. It was their 663rd clinic. Patients used to line up at midnight to get free care, but because the demand is so great, it's not uncommon to now see people in line at 3:30 p.m. to get care the next day. 12 hours later at 3:30 a.m., RAM gives out about 800 numbers. If you're number 801, you'll have to come back and try again. And the overall process begins at 5 a.m. In the richest country on earth, people are waiting in line for at least 15 hours to get their teeth and eyes examined. As the Supreme Court hears arguments in the health care case and the debate rages on, it's important to emphasize the fact that dental and vision are usually not covered by most insurance plans. I spent the day at the clinic on Friday. Pamela Kongdong, president of RAM California, which was just formed in September, says it takes about 6 months to raise the $175,000 needed to run a 4-day clinic. About 3,200 patients are served, and over $1 million worth of services are provided. Kongdong is hoping to raise enough money to buy 20 dental chairs and a vision lab. Because the demand is so great, RAM California is hoping to run weekend clinics and travel to the state's rural areas. Each clinic relies on about 2,000 volunteers. Most people show up at 5 a.m., leave in the evening, and come back the next day. They're some of the most dedicated and caring people you'll ever meet. This form of humanitarian activism deserves far more attention. If you want to see what the clinic looks like, just do a quick search for Remote Area Medical. It's an incredible operation. The large dental room is filled with about 100 chairs, dentists, hygienists, trays, equipment, and a very busy sterilization area. I met 49-year-old Sharon Williams, a former postal worker who was hurt on the job 12 years ago. She hasn't had her teeth cleaned since. She's still fighting for disability benefits, and she has no health care. She had a dental exam, got new glasses, saw a chiropractor, and had acupuncture. And then over in the vision area, I met 19-year-old G. McNeil. G. hasn't had her eyes checked since she was in elementary school. Her vision is so bad, she walks around in a blur. She used to sit in the front row of her classroom so she could see the chalkboard. Her teachers used to tell her to get glasses, but her family could not afford the exam. She was elated when her glasses arrived. She said, quote, "I can finally see." Now, these are just two of the many stories I heard throughout the day and into the evening. Most of the people I met either have jobs or were hurt on the job. Several do have health insurance, but it doesn't cover dental and vision. When I left at 7 o'clock, I was shocked to see people already in line hoping to get care the next day. I met two substitute teachers and a caregiver. Now, while it was heartening to see people scream with joy because they can finally see or shed tears while telling me how well the volunteers treated them, it's outrageous that in a country with so much wealth, this clinic is needed in the first place. Over the next few months, RAM will be in Sacramento, California, Bristol, Tennessee, Pikeville, Kansas, Wise County, Virginia, and Oklahoma City. According to founder Stan Brock, you can close your eyes and stick a pin on the U.S. map and go there. You'll find thousands of people that need services. The fact is, we're still seeing people dying of bad teeth in this country. And this quote really says it all. I'd like to see us work ourselves out of a job so we can concentrate our efforts where we began, in places like the Amazon and Haiti, of course. But Stan Brock says we're bogged down here in the United States, I think, for years and years to come. You can find my video with Stan Brock and take a look at what RAM actually looks like in the dental area at uprisingradio.org. I'm Rose Aguilar for Uprising.
Thanks, Rose. This is Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. The great American writer Mark Twain once said, "Civilization is the limitless multiplication of unnecessary necessities." His observations on the human condition and on the United States persist even today. Born Samuel Langhorne Clemens, Twain went on to write among the best known and loved of American novels, The Adventures of Tom Sawyer and its sequel, Adventures of Huckleberry Finn. He was a grand character whose political views evolved over time to strong positions against U.S. imperialism and war. Twain positioned himself also as a staunch abolitionist and supporter of women's rights. For decades, actor Hal Holbrook has performed an award-winning one-man show called Mark Twain Tonight. Now, actor Val Kilmer presents a new take on Mark Twain in his own one-man show that he has written and directed and performs in, called Citizen Twain. Kilmer is known for his roles in well-known Hollywood productions like Batman Forever and Top Gun. He performs his play in a limited run at the historic Masonic Lodge at Hollywood Forever Cemetery over only two weekends this month. Citizen Twain has already been seen in development at the Disney Concert Hall and Tim Robbins's The Actors Gang. Kilmer will also share a reading from the play at an event this Saturday, March 31st, called All In for the 99%. I spoke with Val Kilmer about his play Citizen Twain yesterday at the Masonic Lodge at Hollywood Forever Cemetery while he was getting his makeup done. I began by asking him why he chose to write a play about Mark Twain.
If you know anything about him, he's the best choice. Walt Whitman's great, and Benjamin Franklin often comes to mind, but who really knows everything about the United States? And it's also that he's so funny, and it's also that he's got such a love of all the spectrum that makes up the United States. It's very real with him. It's not a... There's not another aim to it. So you trust him because he really does love everybody. He really does. And it's a very hard thing to do.
He had a way with words, and I'm wondering how you incorporated his own writings into this play in a way that brought him to life.
Well, you know, the great Hal Holbrook has been doing a very specific one-man show, although the material changes often. He does him as Twain is alive and as a lecture. And he's been doing this since 1954.
Right, I was going to ask you how your play is different from that.
Which is an amazing feat. But that's... As far as I know from the video and seeing his play several times and talking to him, it's exclusively Twain as a public figure. So what I'm hoping to bring to the public is a sense of the duality, that there's Mark Twain, who is this public figure, just like there's a kind of Uncle Sam persona of the United States, loud and grand and even bullying, but undeniable. You know, that Uncle Sam character is talking about taking your child. I want you, is what the caption says. So then the Sam Clemens character, which is, I think, what makes my play different than Hal Holbrook's concept, is that it's a bit as if we went backstage sometimes. Mm. You know, he was a phenomenally inept businessman, and he threw away two fortunes, and he was greedy.
How do you incorporate, or do you incorporate, his political views? Because Twain was somebody whose politics evolved. He went from being a war supporter to being a leading anti-imperialist. Do you bring those issues up?
I certainly am intending to. What I'm involved with in this first play, I should preface this by saying it is extremely difficult for me to edit anyway. It's not a strength of mine at all. And I love, the only solace I get in how long it takes me to do it is from a great thought, I'm probably paraphrasing it, from Tennessee Williams, who said the challenge in writing is not in finding your diamonds, but in learning how to cut them. And for Twain, it's just really, really difficult for me to keep him under 3 hours. So I don't have an intermission. I think it's important, especially to air on the comedy side of the evening, because it's basically a stand-up night.
Can you share a taste of the play with our listeners, a few lines?
Sure. One of the things, talk about politics, that he said, he doesn't know where he's at in the audience, so he says, "Are you Shriners or Elks? Here we are in the Masonic Lodge. Are you Congress? You're not Congress? All right, imagine you're a member of Congress. Now, imagine you're an idiot." But I repeat myself. "Oh, Congress, I've never seen a body that could talk so long and without getting rid, talk for a week without getting rid of an idea." I also do a little piece on the being Native, being part Native American. He says, "I'm a border ruffian from the state of Missouri, and I'm a adopted by the state of Connecticut. So in me, you have Missouri morals and Connecticut culture. This, ladies and gentlemen, is the combination which makes the best man. But where are my ancestors? My first ancestor in America was an Indian, but your ancestors skinned him. They skinned him alive. Now, I do not object to that if you needed his fur, but in front of company. That's what rankles." And then he goes on to say, "Why don't you do the same thing that you did to my forefathers? Why don't you come naked before us?" And it's pretty harsh. And I go on and I tweak a few words and turn it into, "I've got an idea. Why don't you take up a collection and all go back east and occupy Plymouth Rock? And then sell Plymouth Rock and take that money and build a monument of apology to our Native American brothers whom we have wronged. We have wronged them. It was wonderful to find America, but it would have been more wonderful to miss it."
How much of this is your own writing?
I haven't added it up, but it's probably 10%. Transitions and a couple of ideas that I'm, obviously taking a big risk with the purists, but I think it's justified in there are particularly his thoughts about God, which get presented in most of biographies as a, he's either painted as an atheist or an agnostic, and it, neither of those are true. He's just pretty accurate and pretty hilarious about religion. And his fascination with Christian Science has never been really properly addressed. I say properly because I think that it is his closest consistent relationship with the religion. So it's obviously, it's not an accident. I mean, he knew everybody, and he could have written a biography about Grant. He financed it and saved Grant's estate. He financed a biography about the Pope, but he didn't write about those guys. He wrote about Mary Baker Eddy. So it's not a kind of whim, and it just gets dismissed very often. What, because I think there's too a lot of inconsistency in his own writing. On stage, I have him say, which I'm absolutely sure of, he would say if he were alive, that this book I wrote about her is my worst book. Mm-hmm. It's just bad. It's just bad, right? Plus, it's shoddy journalism. I think he was jealous that fact that she was a successful woman writer. I think he was very upset. He was very spoiled. He was upset that she wouldn't meet him. And that a lot of stuff that he wrote that he privately confessed to his daughter that he regretted, he didn't publicly address late in life because of his pride, because he didn't want to be seen as having made a mistake.
How do you make Mark Twain relevant to our current landscape today? You're going to be doing a reading from your play at an event, All In for the 99%.
Right.
And how do you make Mark Twain relevant to what's happening today in the United States with the Occupy Wall Street movement?
Well, I don't think it takes any effort of just drawing obvious... for that is just editing. Unfortunately, it's no stretch to make current his opinions and insight into what he identifies as the real Civil War, which is not, it's a convenience to just say North and South, black and white, or to say a young and old issue, or a liberal or conservative. It's those clashes are small compared to what is always going on with every human being who's striving to improve their life or to live a humane moral life in relation to their surroundings. And that's the struggle between greed and accepting what it really means to be an American, to be open-hearted about judgment, to not judge. We don't have a right to do that. You can say whatever you want, but you don't have a right to tell someone how to live. That's at the foundation of our government, and we started off with a lie. We have 8 presidents that own slaves. George Washington owned hundreds of slaves. And every woman on earth knows that slavery is still involved. I keep bringing this point up, especially with women journalists, because it's so easy to talk about. You guys don't get paid the same amount of money. Why?
That's men.
That's men consciously lying in your face all day long, because no man will say why. No man will. But they're men in your business who are secretly, pervertedly taking advantage of a custom, which is an abusive custom. It doesn't make any sense. There is no answer, right? There's no answer to racism, really, except, you know, lunacy, which is more common now, but we're still going along. Our nation just allowed the world to accept that we would go along with a story that likens our president to Hitler because he's a popular speaker. That is not acceptable. No, it's not American. You know, it isn't what our country's founded on, a beautiful yearning, not on rigid rules. And that yearning, Mark Twain lived. He was born in a dirt floor, and he didn't see color. He loved hanging out with the ex-slaves, and his dad owned slaves. He wasn't taught that there was anything wrong with slavery, but his natural experience was very like my white friends that were involved or kids through heyday and apartheid, where it's just the way it is. You know, you might privately, very quietly grieve because you know, it's not correct, but it's how you live. You're not going to go put your life on the line and, you know, really take up arms in Soweto because you'll be killed. Now, a lot of people did that in the struggles before the Civil War, and Mark Twain never claims to being heroic, the opposite. But he did a very heroic thing as a writer and as an artist in really coming to grips with the failure of the Civil War.
Val Kilmer plays Mark Twain in his new one-man play, Citizen Twain, which he's performing at the Masonic Lodge at the Hollywood Forever Cemetery, starting this Friday, March 30th through Wednesday, April 11th. You can find out details about the times online at hollywoodforever.com. And if you'd like to go see Val Kilmer in his one-man play, Citizen Twain, call us right now at 818-985-5735. We will reserve a pair of tickets for you for the Sunday, April 8th performance at 2 p.m. of Citizen Twain, performed by Val Kilmer, actor who is best known perhaps for his roles in such films as Batman Forever and Top Gun. Again, 818-985-5735. We have only 10 pairs of tickets, so the next 10 callers who call in will win a pair of tickets to see Val Kilmer perform his play Citizen Twain at the Hollywood Forever Cemetery at the Masonic Lodge. And we have tickets only for the Sunday, April 8th, 2 p.m. performance. This is Uprising for Sonali. Subversive thought for the day. Mark Twain once said, "Civilization is the limitless multiplication of unnecessary necessities." That's Mark Twain. That's Sonali's subversive thought for the day. You've been listening to Uprising. Martina Steiner is our assistant producer. Chiara Borghetti is our intern. Chris Bennett is our music curator. And Teddy Robinson is our engineer. Special thanks to Bibhasha Shom. Visit us online at uprisingradio.org, where you can listen to all of our interviews, rate them, leave comments, share them on Facebook, and find links and events we mention on the air. Send your story ideas to mail at uprisingradio.org. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kohatkar. Thanks so much for listening. I'll see you tomorrow at 8. I tiptoe on a stiff rope bouncing. I tiptoe.